The icy coldness of battle still gripped him. His mind felt needle-sharp and his vision clear, every sense enhanced. The girl stopped struggling and looked back at him. The image of a trapped leopard was perfect. Peter had never seen eyes so fierce and merciless as she glared at him. Then she drew back her head like a cobra about to strike and spat at him. White, frothy spittle splattered down the front of Peter's legs. Colin Noble was beside Peter now, pulling off his gas mask.
"I'm sorry, Peter, I was going for the heart."
"You'll never hold me," shrieked the girl suddenly. "I'll be free before Thanksgiving." And Peter knew she was right. The punishment that a befuddled world society meted out to these people was usually only a few months' imprisonment, and that often suspended. He remembered the feel of the dying child in his arms, the warm trickle of her blood running over his belly and legs. "My people will come for me," the girl spat again, this time into the face of one of the men who still held her down. "You will never hold me. My people will force you to free me." Again, she was right. Her capture was a direct invitation for further atrocity. The wheel of vengeance and retribution was set in motion. For the life of this trapped and vicious predator, hundreds more would suffer, and dozens more would die. The reaction was setting in now, the battle rage abating, and Peter felt the nausea cloying his bowels. It had been in vain, he thought. He had thrown away a lifetime's strivings and endeavour to win only a temporary victory. He had checked the forces of evil, not beaten them, and they would regroup and attack again, stronger and more cunning than ever. And this woman would lead them again. "We are the revolution!" The girl lifted her uninjured arm in the clenched fist salute. "We are the power! Nothing, nobody can stop us!" When this woman had fired a load of buckshot through the swollen body of the pregnant woman, it had distorted her shape completely. The image was recaptured entire and whole in Peter's memory, the way she had burst open like the pod of a ripe fruit. The blonde woman shook the clenched fist into Peter's face. "This is only the beginning. The new era has begun." There was a taunt and a sneering threat in her voice, uttered in complete confidence, and Peter knew it was not misplaced. There was a new force unleashed in the world, something more deadly than he had believed possible, and Peter had no illusions as to the role that blind fortune had played in his small triumph. He had no illusion either that the beast was more than barely wounded. Next time, it would be more powerful, more cunning, having learned from this inconsequential failure. And with the reaction from battle came a powerful wave of dread and despair that seemed to overwhelm his soul. It had all been in vain. "You can never win," taunted the woman, splattered with her own blood, but undaunted and unrepentant, seeming to read his very thoughts. "And we can never lose," she shrieked.
"Gentlemen,"
the South African Prime Minister spoke with painful deliberation,
"my cabinet and I are firmly of the opinion that to accede to the terrorists' demands is to take a seat on the back of the tiger from which we will never be able to dismount."
He stopped, hung his great granite-hewn head for a moment, and then looked up at the two ambassadors.
"However, such is the duty we owe to humanity and the dignity of human life, and such is the pressure which two great nations can bring to bear upon one much smaller, that we have decided unanimously to agree in full to all the conditions necessary for the release of the women and children."
A telephone on the tabletop in front of the American ambassador began to shrill irritatingly, and the Prime Minister paused, frowned slightly.
"However, we place complete faith in the undertaking given by your government."
He stopped again, for the telephone insisted.
"You had better answer that, sir,"
he told Kelly Constable. Excuse me, Prime Minister. The American lifted the receiver, and as he listened, an expression of utter disbelief slowly changed his features. Hold the line, he said into the receiver, and then, covering the mouthpiece with his hand, he looked up. Prime Minister, it is a very great pleasure to inform you that 3 minutes ago, the Thor assault team broke into Flight 070 and killed three of the terrorists. They wounded and captured a fourth terrorist, but there were no casualties among the passengers. They got them all out, every last one of them, safe and sound. The big man at the head of the table sagged with relief in his seat, and as the storm of jubilation and self-congratulation broke about him, he started to smile. It was a smile that transformed his forbidding features, the smile of an essentially fatherly and kindly man. Thank you, sir, he said, still smiling. Thank you very much. You are guilty of blatant dereliction of your duty, General Stride, Kingston Parker accused grimly. My concern was entirely with the lives of hostages and the force of moral law. Peter answered him quietly. It was less than 15 minutes since he had penetrated the hull of the Boeing in a blaze of fire and fury. His hands were still shaking slightly, and the nausea still lay heavily on his guts. You deliberately disobeyed my specific orders. Parker was an enraged lion. The mane of thick, shot silver hair seemed to bristle, and he glowered from the screen. The vast power of his personality seemed to fill the command cabin of the Hawker. I have always had grave reservations as to your suitability for the high command with which you have been entrusted. I have already expressed those reservations in writing to your superiors, and they have been fully justified. I understand by all that I have been removed from command of Thor, Peter cut in brusquely, his anger seething to the surface. And Parker checked slightly. Peter knew that even Kingston Parker could not immediately fire the hero of such a successful counterstrike. It would take time, a matter of days perhaps, but Peter's fate was sealed. There could be no doubt of that. And Parker went on to confirm this. You will continue to exercise command under my direct surveillance. You will make no decision without referring directly back to me. No decision whatsoever. Do you understand that, General Stride? Peter did not bother to reply. He felt a wildly reckless mood starting to buoy his sagging spirits, a sense of freedom and choice of action such as he had never known before. For the first time in his career, he had deliberately disobeyed a superior officer, and luck or not, the outcome had been a brilliant success. Your first duty now will be to withdraw all four units, and swiftly, and in as good an order as possible. The militant you have taken will be returned to London for questioning and trial. Her crimes were committed here. She should be tried here for murder. I have already had demands from the local. Arrangements are being made with the South African authorities. Parker's anger had not abated, but he had it better under control. She will return to Britain aboard your command aircraft, with a Thor doctor in attendance. Peter remembered what had happened to the terrorist Laila Khaled, dragged from the El Al airliner where she was being held by Israeli security agents. As a guest of the British police, she had spent 6 short days in captivity, and then been released in a blaze of publicity and glory. Heroine of the communications media, Joan of Arc of terror, released to plan and execute the death and destruction of hundreds more innocents, to lead the attack on the foundations of civilization, to shake the columns that held aloft the rule of law and society. I want this woman in London within 24 hours. She is to be strictly guarded at all times against retaliation. We cannot afford another bloodbath like the one you led on 070. Peter Stride walked very erect, very tall, into the echoing, marble-columned domestic departures hall of the airport. And his men called to him as he came, "Well done, sir! Great stuff, General! Way to go!" They were tending the released passengers, reassembling their scattered gear, dismantling the security and communications equipment, and packing it away. Within the hour, they would be ready to pull out. But now they left their tasks to crowd about him, competing to shake his hand. The passengers realized that this must be the architect of their salvation, and they cheered him as he passed slowly through the hall. And now he was smiling, acknowledging their pitiful gratitude, stopping to talk with an old lady and submitting to her tearful embrace. "God bless you, my boy, God bless you." And her body trembled against him. Gently, Peter set her aside and went on. And though he smiled, it was with his lips only, for there was steel in his heart. There were four guards on the main administrative offices on the mezzanine floor, armed with submachine guns. But they stood aside for him, and Peter went through. Colin Noble was still in his black skin-tight assault suit, with a big 45 on his hip and a cheroot clamped between his teeth. "Take a look at this lot," he called to Peter. The desk was covered with explosives and weapons. "Most of it's Iron Curtain stuff, but God alone knows where they got these." He indicated the double-barreled shock pistols. "If they had these custom-built, it would have cost them plenty." "They've got plenty," Peter answered dryly. The ransom for the OPEC ministers was $150 million, for the Brown brothers, $25 million. For Baron Altman, another $20 million. That's the defense budget for a nation. He picked up one of the shot pistols and opened the breech. It had been unloaded. "Is this the one she used to gun down the hostages?" Colin shrugged. "Probably. It's been fired through both barrels." Colin was right. There were black specks of burned powder down the short, smooth bores. Peter loaded it with buckshot cartridges from the pile on the desk and walked on down the long office with the covered typewriters on the deserted desks and the airline travel posters decorating the wall. Along one row, the three bodies of the hijackers were laid out in a neat row, each encapsulated in its separate, translucent plastic envelope. Two Thor men were assembling the contents of their pockets, personal jewelry, meager personal effects, and they were packing them into labelled plastic bags. The body of Peter's number two was against the far wall, also in his plastic body bag, and Peter stooped over him. Through the plastic he could make out the features of the dead man's face. The eyes were wide and the jaw hung open slackly. "Death is always so undignified," Peter thought, and straightened up. Still carrying the shot pistol, Peter went on into the inner office, and Colin Noble followed him. They had the girl on another stretcher, a plasma drip suspended above her, and the Thor doctor and his two orderlies were working over her quietly. But the young doctor looked up irritably as Peter pushed open the door. Then his expression changed as he recognized Peter. "General, if we're going to save this arm, I have to get her into theatre pretty damn quickly. The joint of the shoulder is shattered." The girl rolled the lovely head towards Peter. The thick, springing golden hair was matted with drying blood, and there was a smear of it across one cheek. Now her face was completely drained of all colour, like the head of an angel carved out of white marble. The skin had a waxen, almost translucent lustre, and only the eyes were still fierce, not dulled by the pain-killing drugs that they had injected into her. "I've asked the South Africans for cooperation," the doctor went on. "They have two top orthopaedic surgeons standing by, and they've offered a helicopter to fly her into the central hospital at Edenvale." Already, she was being treated even by Thor as the major celebrity she was. She had taken her first step along the rose-strewn pathway to glory, and Peter could imagine how the media would extol her beauty. They had gone berserk with extravagant praise for the swarthy, ferrety-eyed Leila Khaled, with her fine dark moustache, They would go over the top for this one.